a huge moment to walk into a village powerhouse with the lights on and not hear the diesels running.
An innovative wind diesel system dramatically reduces heating costs in four rural villages. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state gears up for runway and road building in rural Alaska.
We're in over 20 communities across our region, and then we have over 60 projects in those communities. So it's a really busy construction season for us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage, and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Public documents show Governor Sean Parnell's administration worked out a deal with Alaska's major oil producers that allows the companies to withhold tens of millions of dollars in property taxes. The Anchorage Daily News says the 2013 deal occurred after producers disagreed with the state board that set the value of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. The deal was negotiated after an attorney for the oil pipeline owners complained in a June 2013 email that the state assessment review board set the value for the pipeline too high, raising the tax bill for oil companies. The deal to give oil companies at least a temporary break emerged in public view in April when some of the municipalities that receive property taxes on the pipeline appealed the state's 2014 valuation. The Alaska Republican Party has taken measures to prevent a takeover by Libertarian and Tea Party activists. The new rules say a person has to be registered as a Republican for at least 4 years before seeking a top leadership position, and they require all candidates for the party's statewide offices to be vetted by a special committee before they can run. The rules were adopted on Saturday at the Alaska Republican Party's biannual convention. Party Chair Peter Goldberg says the changes are a reaction to a coup staged by a group of Ron Paul supporters at the 2012 convention.
2 years ago, people that were not Republicans were registering to become to be Republicans on the day of their district conventions and participating. That's really not appropriate.
The insurgents elected a libertarian-leaning chair and vice chair, but the Alaska Republican Party's old guard kicked them out of office last year. Very few of those insurgents were present at this year's convention, which was held in Juneau, but the 2016 convention will happen in Fairbanks, making an influx of dissidents more likely. If that happens, Goldberg says the new rules will make it harder for party outsiders to seize control.
That's all it is, just to make sure that the people that participate as Republicans really, in their hearts, are Republicans, and they're not just showing up to try and change the course of the party.
The convention delegates adopted the changes with significant support, but not without protest. Lance Roberts, a delegate from Fairbanks, was part of the 2012 takeover, and he repeatedly tried to amend the new rules. He believes Republican moderates are trying to shut out the right wing.
I think it's completely the wrong direction. We should be more open, more honest, and we should be inviting these people.
In addition to changing party rules, the convention delegates condensed the Alaska Republican platform. There was also a failed effort to strike language opposing the expansion of gay rights, with a third of the party delegates voting to take those sections out of the platform. It's hard to use wind as a main power source because it fluctuates. But four small Alaskan villages have succeeded in creating an innovative wind diesel system that works even in harsh, variable weather conditions. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Five giant wind turbines loom on the outskirts of Kangiginuk, just as they do outside Kipnuk, Quingilinoc, and Tuntutuliak, which all lie about 50 miles apart and 100 miles outside Bethel. 9 years ago, leaders from the four villages formed the Chinigruk Wind Group to bring a reliable, more cost-effective power source than diesel to the four villages. Patrick Boonstra is a project manager for Intelligent Energy Systems, the Anchorage-based wind Gen Diesel technology firm that facilitated the Chininga project. He says a diesel power plant is needed to keep the lights on when the wind isn't blowing and to run converters, distribution systems, and controls. But he says since the wind turbines came online, wind powers those systems from a third to half the time.
That's huge. That's a huge moment to walk into a village powerhouse with the lights on and not hear the diesels running.
The turbines had to be tailored for a climate where temperatures hover around 0 8 months out of the year. Boonstra says they also generate twice as much energy as villagers would need at any given time.
The idea for having more potential capacity on the wind side than the load is so that we can find ways of harnessing and storage of the wind when it does happen in order to hold it for when we need it.
Boonstra says the excess energy is stored in batteries and even in stoves in people's homes to draw upon when the wind is not blowing.
And they take the excess wind energy that would normally just be burned off as heat or we'd turn a turbine off. They take that energy and store it in heat bricks in these people's homes.
Is that new and unusual or common?
It is. It is a new thought and it is unusual. It's the first of a kind up here.
Boonstra says broadband internet technology came to the region about 2 years ago and made several other innovations possible, including meters that give managers precise data and the ability to set automation to operate by the microsecond or for managers to take over manually.
We have remote access to the powerhouse from here in town to diagnose problems, as well as we can switch wind turbines on and off, diesel power, and that as well wouldn't necessarily be possible without this fast internet connection.
Smart meters also track usage, allowing homeowners to increase efficiencies and managers to identify areas that need troubleshooting. Rodney Phillip of Kangiginuk says the system has dramatically cut heating costs there.
An average home in our village burns up to 500 gallons a year in heating fuel. But if we use that energy efficient home, 55 gallons a year, that's about almost 90% fuel displacement.
Most of the project funding came from the Alaska Energy Authority's Renewable Energy Fund, with additional support from federal, private, and nonprofit sources. The TAB runs about $3.3 million per village.
Frankly, I think that's a success story.
Anna Sattler is community liaison for the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative.
I think that technology is going to get less expensive and it'll be available, you know, throughout Alaska if it works. And they're the ones that are testing it. We're grateful to them.
The jobless rate for the four villages is 48%, and almost a third of residents live below the poverty level. Not so long ago, electricity and heating fuel took up half of many household incomes. Work installing the turbine diesel systems in all four villages is expected to be complete in 2016. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Just 2 weeks after the strongest earthquake in the region in more than 30 years, residents of Noatak and others near the far western edge of the Brooks Range felt another series of powerful quakes over the weekend. Mike West is a state seismologist and director of the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks. He says the 5.5 magnitude quake that struck less than an hour after midnight Friday came about 2 weeks to the day after an even stronger quake on April 18th.
The second one, it now has its own whole set of aftershocks. There was quite a number of earthquakes all through Saturday that were part of the aftershock sequence of this second earthquake.
Those aftershocks were similarly strong, with seven rated a magnitude 4 or stronger. West says the two strong quakes followed by powerful aftershocks are likely caused by the same geological forces.
It's important to think of this as a sequence. Stress was building up through the normal movement of plate tectonics, and that needed to be relieved. The earthquake on April 18th, Friday's earthquake, all the aftershocks from both of those are all sort of part of this process.
Like April's quake, Friday night's shaker was felt in Noatak, at the giant Red Dog zinc mine, and even in Kotzebue. Despite the powerful second shake, West says there's no danger beyond frayed nerves on the horizon. Nonetheless, the Earthquake Center is visiting Noatak and Kotzebue this week to install seismology equipment to better observe the activity.
We have plans right now to install probably two seismic stations in and around the source of the earthquake. And this is driven not so much by a concern for something to come, but we want to be prepared and, frankly, better understand why these earthquakes occurred in the first place.
The last time the region saw seismic activity on par with these two most recent quakes was back in 1981, when a 5.5 quake struck in roughly the same area, some 30 miles north of Noatak. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, UAA revises the new sports center design to include a brew pub.
What our hope is that they, those people that are going out to dinner, choose to come to the Varsity Sports Grill.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A fire warning issued last week for northern southeast Alaska has been expanded to the whole region. Tongass National Forest Fire Management Officer Seth Ross says continued warm, dry weather is affecting more areas. He's not predicting large blazes, but he says hunters, hikers, boaters, and campers should be extra careful.
We just wanted to kind of talk to folks who are coming back into the woods and just, you know, gentle reminder, you know, just be careful. And the conditions certainly are right for some fire activity.
Ross says dry grass and brush creates the biggest risk. The same conditions have led Juneau's municipal government to issue a full burn ban within its boundaries. That includes trash piles, campfires, and barbecues using wood or charcoal. Forest fire is not common in southeast, but Ross says an average of 17 happen each year. Some years have as many as 40.
They're not big. They don't spread out very far. They do go deep in the right conditions. We do end up with some fires that burn down a few layers in underground, but nothing gets too big.
Ross's warning continues until the weather changes. Juneau's warning goes until 4 p.m. Tuesday, but could be extended. Breakup along the Yukon River is underway as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports warm temperatures over the weekend and low water levels mean river ice is rotting in place before it has a chance to jam up.
Teams with the National Weather Service and the Department of Homeland Security flew parts of the middle Yukon River last week to monitor the ice as it starts to break up. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum was on a flight between Galena and Tanana. He says this year, those middle Yukon River communities are likely to see what's called a thermal breakup.
The ice is just sitting in the river and soaking up the sun, and there's not enough water to start pushing the ice downriver. So you can get several breakups forming along the river where ice starts to shift and move. And during a thermal breakup, you can actually have multiple breakup fronts.
Plum says large ice jams that hold back lots of water are unlikely this year, in part because the water level along much of the Yukon is low.
Out in the western part of the state, we had a much lower than normal snowfall on the ground. So the snowpack was much below normal by the time we came into the spring. Also, we had kind of a gradual warming, you know, it started at the beginning of April. And so we've slowly just melted off what snowpack we have had.
Further upriver, Plum says communities like Fort Yukon and Eagle may also have an easy breakup this year, even though snowpack there was at or above normal. He says the river ice on the upper Yukon is likely to either rot or mush out. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Federal money for rural infrastructure is drying up, and state agencies are overhauling projects while they still can. With Alaska's brief construction season about to begin, state officials are hurrying to bring airfields, roads, and other bush infrastructure up to standard before funds get scarce. KNOM's Zechariah Hughes reports.
The Alaska Department of Transportation is preparing for a busy summer in rural parts of the state.
This is a $240 million construction season for us, and we're in over 20 communities across our region, and then we have over 60 projects in those communities. So it's a really busy construction season for us.
Meadow Bailey is a DOT spokesperson in charge of most bush projects. She's making the rounds ahead of the construction season to get acquainted with project sites and meet local officials. In Nome, the DOT is starting a $26 million runway extension at the airport in mid-May. More road and airport work is planned for Barrow, Kotzebue, Shishmaref, Imanac, and elsewhere, along with an extensive new road project in Tanana.
We're building about 18 miles of new road close to the community of Tanana. And the goal there is to be able to open up a mining corridor that has existing mines on it right now, but to give more access for those miners, and then to also allow the residents of Tanana, or enable the residents of Tanana, to have a lower cost of living.
DOT is aggressively pursuing rural programs this summer in part because plans for larger projects fell through during the legislative session. Bailey says the state also expects federal money for infrastructure is going to decrease in the next few years.
We have dollars right now, and we have projects in rural communities. Last year, this year, next year, we're going to try to build and improve as much as we can, because we know that federal funding, that there's going to be a shift in what will qualify for federal funding.
More than 90% of Alaska's money for airports, roads, and the Southeast Ferry System comes from federal money. And not only are those funds diminishing, but Bailey says nationwide spending priorities are shifting towards cities.
The focus is going to be more on urban areas. And so there's a lot of focus on more transit programs like busing, cycling paths, that kind of stuff, and mass transit. And so in Alaska, that's going to really change the focus from the rural communities to the more urban communities.
With a looming sea change in funding priorities, Alaska DOT is proactively trying to bring remote roadways and airstrips up to date. That's not an easy task in an area where a single-lane gravel road can cost up to $1 million a mile. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
State transportation officials agree that a burst water pipe likely caused the Skagway ferry dock to sink last month. Repairs continue in hopes of getting the dock operational and returning ferry service to the southeast community within the next week. The state is making repairs and some modifications to the dock now that it's floating again. Department of Transportation spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says it's not yet known how much the salvage and repairs from the sinking will cost the state. Woodrow says the state is hoping to resume ferry service to Skagway on May 11th. A final decision on that timeline will be made later this week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
With around 4 months left until it's slated to open, the University of Alaska Anchorage is tweaking the design of its new sports complex. The university has decided to add a new restaurant in an effort to draw in the surrounding community. APRN's Josh Edge toured the facility last month.
Though much of the finishing work remains, the interior of the Alaska Airlines Center is beginning to take shape. From the newly installed floor of the performance gym, which is lit largely by natural light streaming in through a number of massive windows, you get a good idea of just how central it is to the building's design. Two levels of stadium seating, capable of holding about 5,000 spectators, surround the floor. Coaching offices overlook the gym, and peering up to the top floor, you can see five hospitality suites with a prime view of the court. According to Talisa Northcutt, the director of development for Seawolf Athletics, those suites aren't the only thing occupying the arena's uppermost level.
There's also a restaurant going in that will be like 360 days a year. It's not just for campus. It's really meant to be kind of an addition for the community in this area. It'll be known as Varsity Sports Grill.
Northcutt says the grill will be open for lunch and dinner daily and should seat approximately 100 people at its indoor tables.
There's also a lovely patio. It's amazing. It has a great view. It will actually be able to expand the seating for most of the year. They're looking at putting propane heaters and that sort of thing out there too.
The patio, which faces the Chugach Mountains to the east, should fit around 80 people. The restaurant is a late addition to the arena's original design and was approved by the University of Alaska Board of Regents in April. Bill Spindle is the Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services at UAA.
It's not the classic brew pub where they're, brewing their own beer. But it has a lot of the characteristics of a brew pub. You know, it'll be something, like if you went to the Glacier Brew House, it'd be something similar to that. It's a place where you can have a really good meal and a drink if you want.
Though the restaurant will have some food options for students, its focus is to bring in others who live and work in the surrounding area. Beer and wine will be for sale at the restaurant, which, according to Spindle, marks a shift in UAA's alcohol policy.
The university has not allowed alcohol on campus except for specific restricted events. And so we have redone our policy and got approval from the chancellor for the arena only to have beer and wine at particular events.
In addition to allowing the sale of beer and wine at the Varsity Sports Grill, the new policy will also enable alcohol sales at athletic events, though details about that process are still in development. UAA Athletic Director Keith Hackett hopes the restaurant will help make the new sports center into a community destination.
When people come to sporting events, 75% of them go out to dinner before or after an event. So what our hope is that those people that are going out to dinner choose to come to the Varsity Sports Grill.
The restaurant will be operated by NANA Management Services. Spindle says the Alaska Airlines Center is still on track to open September 5th. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
To see a copy of UAA's revised alcohol policy, go to alaskapublic.org. City officials are hoping to address Juneau's long-standing housing shortage by opening more public land to development. The Juneau Planning Commission recently recommended about 150 acres of city-owned land on Patterson Hill to be rezoned to allow a residential neighborhood to be built. The idea is to copy the early 20th century style subdivisions of downtown Juneau and Douglas, but not everybody is happy about the proposal. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
I'm following Greg Cheney through the woods at the base of Pedersen Hill. As we climb over downed trees, stumps, and piles of deer poop, it's hard to imagine this as the site of a residential neighborhood. But that's exactly what Cheney envisions here.
It's very reminiscent of downtown. If you go from the waterfront up to the Capitol building, there's kind of a gentle hill, and that's the kind of terrain that we have here.
Cheney is lands and resources manager for the city and borough of Juneau. When the city decides to buy or sell some property, he's the guy responsible for making it happen. In the past decade, Juneau has sold about 30 lots in the Lena Point area to private builders, many of which have been developed into high-end single-family homes. The city recently put two more Lena lots on the market. Cheney says Pedersen Hill could be the location of the city's next land sale.
We really have a strong mandate from the community to try to do something to provide entry-level housing or workforce housing. So that's where we're going to try to come in and facilitate something.
The Lena Point subdivision includes lot sizes up to 66,000 square feet. Cheney says the Pedersen Hill proposal is for lots a tenth that size or smaller, more like Star Hill or the Flats neighborhoods downtown.
When you're developing a subdivision, the more houses you can put in that subdivision, the less it costs per unit for roads, water, sewer, streetlights, all the improvements. So there's a real advantage to doing that a little bit higher density. It also makes for a more walkable neighborhood.
Pedersen Hill is located between the Mendenhall River and Auk Lake near Glacier Highway. Right now, there's no road access to the city's property, something that would have to be figured out before any development takes place. Optimistically, Cheney says land could be ready for sale to private builders in the next 2 years, but realistically, he says it will take a lot longer than that.
There's so many public hearings that are required and permitting. We have to go through the Army Corps of Engineers. We have to have DOT agree. We have to work out with the adjacent landowners to get access. It's amazing how much work it is to put something on the ground, especially if you're on the government side, because you have a lot of oversight.
When all is said and done, Cheney thinks a few hundred lots could be part of the Pedersen Hill development. According to the Juneau Economic Development Council, the city could add more than 500 new single-family homes and about 200 new rental units across the borough without significantly impacting the housing market. At a recent Juneau Assembly meeting, Exit Realty's Mike Band said the biggest need is for single-family starter homes priced between $250,000 and $300,000. Ban is part of a group of local stakeholders formed by the Assembly to provide input on housing issues.
It's getting harder and harder and harder to find those homes. And as it gets more and more difficult, people, you know, young families typically are going to move on.
But not everyone is thrilled about the idea of developing Pedersen Hill. Jim Sidney owns Swampy Acres, a farm and feed store that butts up against the city's property.
I built on the very back of my property, and if you look out my window here in the dining room, you can see the trees right there, and that's right at the beginning of these little lots that they want to put in. That's it right there, because the ditch is about my property line.
Sidney's wife's family homesteaded the area around the same time as the Pedersen family, for which the hill is named. He says a high-density neighborhood nearby would change the character of the area. Remnants of the old Pedersen dairy farm are still standing in a field near the hill.
Yeah, there's something left of the milk parlor, which is where my father-in-law met my my mother-in-law.
Sidney has worked in construction over the years and says he's not opposed to more housing, but he worries about people disturbing his farm and says he'll ask the city to put up a fence whenever development gets underway. He says he's not worried about his livestock, but says Pedersen Hill is habitat for a variety of wildlife.
Very large wildlife corridor. They come down here, go across to Douglas and over to Admiralty, and I've seen wolves back here, coyotes, foxes, deer, moose. Only one moose.
Cheney says the city will work to alleviate some of those habitat issues.
We'll try to leave as much forest as we can in doing the development when we get around to the development. Right now we're just talking about a rezone. So it's just the broad template of what we're going to do.
Right now, Pedersen Hill is zoned for low-density development. The proposed rezone must be approved by the Assembly, which could vote on the issue sometime in the next 2 months. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Matthew Smith and Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez also reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.